today are Mike Adams and John Ness as well. This is a case, first and foremost, that I would submit to you about mootness. This lawsuit was filed by the Chicago Tribune in the very last week of April 2015. By early July 2015, the College of DuPage had produced every document that was in its possession. The only remaining document is a subpoena, and it is a subpoena that is undisputed since April of 2015 has been in the possession of the foundation. Now, what that means is that since July 2015, there are two salient facts. The first is the College of DuPage is not necessary to this dispute. The party that has the subpoena is before the court. That's the foundation. If there is going to be an order to produce the subpoena, it can be done, and was done, directly against the foundation. It is not necessary to have the College of DuPage before this court, and it was not necessary for the College of DuPage to be before the circuit court. The second fact is that because of that, there is no remedy, effective remedy, that can be awarded against the College of DuPage. If ordered to produce this document, there is nothing that the College of DuPage can do to comply with that. We don't have it. And there is no legal right on behalf of the College of DuPage to demand it.
It's your employee who had it, correct?
It is a shared employee who wears two different hats. And they had it for several hours.
Was your employee wearing two hats at once, one on top of the other, or did she alternate?
No, the particular employee, Karen Kuhn, works part-time for the foundation, part-time for the College of DuPage. And when she received this in her foundation capacity, she ran it up the chain of command to the foundation and did as her supervisor at the foundation ordered her to do, to give it to the foundation's counsel.
Did the Tribune seek fees jointly against your client and the foundation?
Yes, they did.
And for want of a better term, does that not at least still pend in some way, shape, or form?
We don't believe it does, Your Honor. And that goes to one of our other points. We are all before you on an appeal of a final judgment. Every party in this case has invoked Rules 301 and 303 of their notices of appeal and on their briefs. And the law is very, very well settled that a circuit court retains jurisdiction to handle post-trial motions for 30 days after entry of a final judgment. And we all agree that what happened on March 17, 2016 was a final judgment. When the Tribune withdrew its fee petition, the circuit court lost jurisdiction and they lost their ability to pursue that fee petition. This is not an interlocutory appeal. It's not here under 304A or 305 or any of the discretionary Supreme Court rules. It's an appeal from a final judgment.
This document hasn't been turned over yet, has it?
It has not.
And therefore, whatever happens in this case, we probably have to remand this for something. If we affirm, it has to be remanded for enforcement. If we deny, I can't think of a reason right now, but it may have to go back just to, our mandate would go back and establish that this is what we did. But if it goes back for enforcement, wouldn't fees be available at that time?
No, they would not. Fees are statutorily possible under the FOIA Act. But they have to be pursued at the time of the circuit court proceedings. Having waived it, having walked away from it now, they cannot reassert this when they come back. And that's, we submit a very clear law on that point under Rules 301, 303, Herlihy, and numerous other decisions. The fact is that the Tribune made a decision. And their decision was, there was a final judgment, and enforcement of that judgment was stayed pending appeal. They wanted the document, they wanted it in a hurry. So they wanted to proceed with this appeal. In fact, they even tried to direct appeal to the Supreme Court because they want the document. When they decided to proceed in a hurry and not take the time to adjudicate their fee petition before the circuit court, they lost the right to pursue that fee petition.
What about Rule 366 that says that the appellate court can enter any order that the trial court could have. In other words, what's keeping this court, if we affirm, from assessing fees if there's a petition filed during the, prior to the deadline for filing a petition for rehearing?
The answer to that is because the circuit court couldn't have awarded fees. The circuit court was not divested of jurisdiction to award fees because of this appeal. The circuit court lost jurisdiction because there was no fee petition that was filed within 30 days of the final judgment.
I thought the petition was filed within 30 days of the judgment. I thought I read that it's ended for 120 days and then it was withdrawn. Am I wrong?
I'm not sure about the 120 days, but you are correct. So the judgment was in March. They filed a fee petition in, I believe, early April. There was some briefing on it, and they walked away from it and abandoned it in, I believe, July. So at the point when they did that, we were very clear in the circuit court in saying, you know, everyone needs to be on notice. They are losing the right to pursue this.
Well, that was your position, and their position was we're not. And the trial court even encouraged them, possibly, if you read that part of the record, that, well, you know, why don't you just withdraw this petition? I'm not dismissing the petition. You're withdrawing the petition. You can handle it later. So while you were clear, the trial court was clear, and I think the Tribune in its argument was clear, too. So we have to decide what really is clear.
Well, I think you're correct. The trial court certainly encouraged them to do this. I think it was actually the trial court's idea originally to do it. That doesn't necessarily make it right as a matter of law. That's why we have appeals, and you're correct. But if I could, I'd like to go back to the first point, which is one of mootness, because regardless of what happens with the fee petition, there can be no fees assessed against the College of DuPage, because the claims against us were mooted at the very outset of this case. And under the prevailing law from this circuit, or from this district rather, voluntary production of documents precludes a finding that the Tribune was a prevailing party on a
Who did Ms. Broad call after the subpoena was served on, I think, her associate in the development office? It went to her. Then who did she call?
You know, I don't know that, Your Honor. The record is silent on that. We know that in April, federal agents showed up. They served subpoenas on COD at COD's business office, and then they left that office and separately served COD's served a subpoena at the foundation office. We know Ms. Kuhn called Ms. Broad. Ms. Broad was on vacation in Arizona at the time. We don't know who Ms. Broad spoke to, but we do know that the instruction that she gave to Ms. Kuhn was to deliver it to the foundation's outside counsel, not the college's counsel. She didn't say deliver it to the president of COD. She didn't say give it to the counsel for COD. She said give it to the foundation's outside counsel. So for that reason, it is our position, I think it's very clear that COD never had possession of this subpoena. It was handled by foundation employees who were acting like foundation employees.
How do we know that? I mean, because they have the same phone number for COD, and they have the same phone number for foundation. It's the same thing. One of them is an extension 1 for the college, extension 2 for the foundation. We don't have any work records that indicate that we've worked for the college for this long. On today's date, we've worked for the foundation for this long. I believe that they're paid by the college, all funds, all salaries paid by the college. Their health benefits are paid for by the college. And since the college is paying for everything, they're probably W-2s are sent out from the college. So how do we know that this was a foundation function on that day?
It's very clear from the record that it was. And before I explain why, I do want to make a point, which is the question you posed and that dispute doesn't need to have the College of DuPage involved. That's an issue that can be litigated without the College of DuPage between the foundation and
the college has an understanding, a memorandum of understanding with the foundation about a lot of things.
Correct, but that does not make the college a necessary party to this dispute.
If they were de facto college employees, then would that make the COD a necessary party?
No, it would not, because the party that has possession, the party that a remedy can be awarded against, is the foundation. There is no argument, even by the Tribune, there's no argument that the College of DuPage can compel the Foundation's outside counsel to do anything.
Is there any indication in the record who pays the workman's comp insurance and benefits in the event that these double-headed employees are injured while on the job?
I don't believe there is anything in the record on that, but I would tell Your Honor that, as far as I know, all the employment aspect of these individuals' jobs is handled by the College of DuPage, and a portion is treated as an in-kind contribution to the Foundation. I would like to answer your question.
Well, let me add one other
sure.
fact. If an employee gets fired by the College of DuPage, are they also fired per se by the Foundation and vice versa?
That's a determination made separately by both bodies. If we were to fire someone, they could make a decision to keep them on or not.
Has that ever happened?
I honestly don't know. I can't, in my experience with the college, I can't think of it, and I also am not aware of anything in the record. I do know the Foundation does, for the last perhaps a year or so at this time, has had an employee. But I do want to answer your question about how we know it was on Foundation business. We know it was on Foundation for the following reasons. It was a subpoena served separately on the Foundation, addressed to the Foundation, served at the Foundation's offices. If the federal agents wanted it to be a COD subpoena, they would have and could have served it at COD's business offices with the other subpoenas.
But I thought it was filed, it was served at the development office and had to be taken to the offices of the Foundation, per what I read from the deposition of the person who first received it. Ms. Krohn or Krohn?
It was Karen Kuhn. And she, the development office at COD, doubles as the Foundation's office. It's a shared office space. So the rest
Why
of
did she say she had to take it somewhere? I mean, there's a reference to, she took it to someone else who then took it to council. Would she just walk across the room?
I believe the testimony was she received it. She called her superior at the Foundation. So again, not the college's president or council, she called her superior at the Foundation. Her superior at the Foundation told her to give it to the Foundation secretary, Karen Kepnick, to deliver to the Foundation's outside counsel. I'm not clear why she just didn't ask Karen Kuhn to deliver it to the Foundation's counsel. I don't know. I'm also not certain that's...
Counsel, your time is up.
All right, thank you.
You have an opportunity to make rebuttal. Foundation counsel, please.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jim Ryan. I represent the College of DuPage Foundation. Unlike many other states, Illinois has a strong privacy right, so much so that they enumerate a privacy right in our state's constitution. That right to privacy is under attack today by a for-profit newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, that has asked the court to use the Freedom of Information Act to strip away the privacy rights of a private, non-for-profit charity merely because the foundation happens to take donated money and use that money to support students who attend a public school.
What do you mean by private?
It is a private, non-for-profit corporation. It is registered under the Illinois General Non-For-Profit Corporations Act. It also has certification under the IRS code 501c3 as a private charitable organization. There is not a single public official or a single public employee who is on the board of directors of the College of DuPage Foundation.
Does the foundation lease the property that it inhabits or has a tenancy on the grounds of COP?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. That doesn't make it a public body.
Do they pay to that lease, or is that paid for by the College of DuPage?
The College of DuPage donates the space pursuant to.
So they're not out in the money?
No, they're not. It's a donation.
I thought the college didn't. Oh, it receives donations through the foundation, but it can donate things to the foundation.
Yes, it can. COD can donate money to whoever it wishes. They choose to donate lease space, and they choose to donate some employee time to the foundation. The foundation can also solicit donations from other people, and then they make grants, and most of the grants go to students who attend COD's.
I believe you cited a First District case relative to
IH essay case?
Yes, absolutely.
And you cited to that reference with your claim that your foundation does not exercise a governmental function?
Correct, yes.
And the rationale or the factual scenario that you suggested was similar to the IH essay case where the court pointed out that no student has the right to be on a team and be an athlete and so on and so forth. You made the parallel or the analogy to no student has the right to receive a scholarship.
Correct.
Are you telling me that that is the only way in which monies that are transferred from your foundation to the college are expended or used?
No, not. The functions that the foundation does are the same functions that many other private charities have. They take donations and they make grants. The College of DuPage Foundation, they have decided that their donated money, they would want to go to be used to help improve the lives of students at COD. We cited the IHSA case because it is the only case in Illinois that defines what a government function is.
Is fundraising by a community college or any institution, educational institution, public, is that or can that be a governmental function?
If a public school raises money, that is a governmental act that's covered under FOIA, because it's a governmental action. It's an official action by
a
government.
You're saying so you're agreeing that is a governmental function?
If the fundraising occurs by COD, yes.
Okay. If COD has a relationship with another entity, for that entity to exclusively raise funds for COD, does it become a governmental function?
No, it does not. And the reason why it does not is because the nature of the function, the actual soliciting of funds, and the dispensing of funds is something that a private person, a private charity, can do without exercising any governmental power whatsoever.
And if this is the only way that COD does that, and doesn't do it in any other form or fashion, if this is the exclusive fundraising arm, it's still not a governmental function.
Well, I don't think that it is the exclusive way that COD raises funds and taxes. It raises funds through tuition. What we're talking about here,
we're talking here is
money that is collected by charity through donations of private people to help the lives of students. That is not something that is necessarily something the government does. COD can decide tomorrow, we don't want to be exclusive anymore. We want to take as many people as we want and collect their money themselves. They've chosen not to do that.
Could you distinguish your syllogism and substitute the College of DuPage for the foundation and explain to me how it's a governmental function that COD does it, despite the fact that private schools, private charities do it. But if it's done by a private charity, it's not a governmental function because there are other private entities that do it as well. It seems that your syllogism doesn't make sense to me, at least, because it seems like if it's a government function, for a government, I don't know how the function changes, unless, of course, the monies that are collected don't go to the government.
Because it's the person who's doing it that matters. Who the actor is matters.
Here, do you have any case law to cite that it is the agent or the actor, despite any memorandum of understanding or any agency relationship or any contract?
Well, the only case in Illinois that is decided this question of what is a government function is the IHS case. And in that case, the judges in the first district asked the question whether the function is necessarily governmental. In the case that was before the court in the IHSA case, the not-for-profit charitable organization did sponsor athletic events that public school students and private school students played. There were members of public employees, principals, who were on the board making decisions for the IHSA on policy and on all sorts of things.
And they were not employed by any of the public schools, correct?
The principals were, but yes.
The board of directors was.
The board of directors.
But the employees of IHSA are not co-employees of some a public institution, correct?
I don't believe so. But the control group, which is critically important based on the Rockford case that this district decided, control is what's important. How the entity is formed is important. What the nature of the function is important. And also, and most importantly, the degree to which the government controls the entity. And in this case, the amount of government control of the foundation is zero. The foundation staff takes direction from the foundation's board of directors, and not a single government official is on that board.
Except the day-to-day events of this foundation are run by the vice president of development, her other job.
Well, when Ms. Brode is a vice president of development at COD, then she's working for COD. When she's executive director of the foundation, she's the executive director of the foundation. They're two different things. It's like a person who is an elected official who is also the president of their campaign committee. They're doing two different things. When they're campaigning, they're not public. They're not engaging in government action. They're not acting as public officials. When they're public officials, they're acting through the government, then they are. And so,
but over here, they're trying to become that government official. They're not going to do the same at the same time, and I don't know too many government officials who are their own campaign chairman. That's really not a good idea.
Well,
just
as long as it can happen, certainly in smaller elections it can happen. But
have you ever heard of Dillon's rule?
Pardon me?
Have you ever heard of Dillon's rule?
I don't know.
Prior to 1970 and the 1970 Constitution, there was no such thing as a home rule or home rule units. And Dillon's rule was a rule pronounced by a judge or Justice Dillon on the Iowa Supreme Court. And it was adopted throughout the United States until such time as home rule came into vogue. And it basically said that governmental entities only had the powers that were expressed in the statute or which were directly implied thereby, or which by necessity would be implied thereby, though not direct. And in the analysis under the Dillon rule, it would seem that when we determine fundraising as an adjunct to teaching students when it costs money and it's not free, that it would be implied, it would fit into the second category of governmental authority or functions. And so could we get back to how it is that it depends on who the actor is as opposed to what the action is? Because I believe it's a noun, it's a function, it's not an active verb, it's not the functionator or something like that. So could you explain how, if there's any case, or maybe clarify what you are trying to explain to me? I'm having a hard time understanding how, as we used to say in college, it's the same, only different.
I think that in the Freedom of Information Act itself, it focuses as a matter of policy that it covers actions of government units, public employees, public officials. The foundation is not that. It is not a public official, it's not a public employee, it's not a unit of government. It's a separate entity. It was created separately. It only has a memorandum of understanding with COD. 30 years down the line, when COD and the foundation stated in that memorandum, it is our intention to keep things separate. We're not taking over. We're not becoming some subsidiary or some fundraising arm. We're separate entities, and we behave as if we are separate.
Does the foundation have the authority to terminate employees? If they want to fire one of their employees, do they have the authority to do that?
Board of directors, yes, it does.
Has that ever happened to you?
To my knowledge, I can't think of one.
Would that employee still have their job with the college if that were to happen?
Yes. The college can make its own decision.
Who issues the W-2s to the employee?
It's my understanding that the college issues a W-2 and then makes an in-kind donation to the foundation, and the foundation books it as an in-kind donation.
But who issues the W-2? Just the college?
I believe so. I'm not sure on that.
They don't get two W-2s?
I'm not sure.
What kind of pension are we talking about?
Pardon me?
What kind of pension are the employees receiving under either hat?
I'm not sure. I believe they receive a pension through the college.
And why does the college, why does the foundation pay for the president of the college's expenses for any reason, including fundraising?
Well, the foundation made a business decision that it would be helpful to their mission.
To employ the president or to pay his expenses? I'm not worried.
Well, the foundation does not employ the president. Certainly, the foundation realizes their fundraising would be better if the president was there. And so the foundation has paid some of those expenses. I think that would be any different if they bring a speaker, they would pay their expenses.
Okay, thank you.
I have one further question.
Sorry.
Actually, it was stated in the briefs, I think a couple of different times, that the employees of the foundation do pay in, they are provided with pension benefit through the state university retirement system. Is that based on the half of their salary that they are paid for being at a College of DuPage employee, or is that based on their entire salary as employees of both entities?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that works, Your Honor. I apologize.
Would you agree that would make a difference? It has the potential to make a difference?
Well, I don't think it does, simply because...
It might make a difference.
Well, when the employee is working for the foundation, their foundation is able to do that because of a separate agreement they have with COD, which would be subject to FOIA by simply asking COD for that agreement and COD produced it. How that person gets compensated, I don't think changes the analysis because it's still basically a loaned employee.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Counsel for the Tribune, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Alexandra Block, and I represent the Chicago Tribune.
You may proceed.
Thank you. The policy behind FOIA is transparency in government operations and expenditures. The stated legislative intent is to make all public records publicly available for inspection unless a statutory exemption applies. And here, there's no claim of any exemption. The only question is whether the federal grand jury subpoena is a public record.
And the trial court made that finding. That was the primary finding by which you're seeking enforcement, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court ruled under Section 7.2 of FOIA that the federal grand jury subpoena is a public record and not produced because the foundation has it pursuant to a contract with the college.
And how does that fit within the Better Government Administration versus the IHSA? Because the appellate panel there has some discussion about that section.
It does. The IHSA case dealt with both the Section 7.2 argument as well as the subsidiary body argument that we make. And there are a number of reasons why IHSA is distinguishable from this case. The first is... the Illinois High School Athletic Association was a voluntary association of both private and public schools that did not manage any public funds. Here, the foundation is the recipient of all donations intended for the college, regardless of whether the foundation solicited those donations. If a donor approaches the college and wishes to contribute, the college directs those donations to a foundation account. That's completely distinguishable from the IHSA, which did not accept any public money or manage any public money.
They do accept private donations.
Does the IHSA? I believe the facts of that case were that the IHSA charged admission to sporting events, and that's how it got funding. I don't believe that there was anything in that decision, at least, about donations. The IHSA is operated by private employees who are on IHSA's payroll as distinguished from the foundation's employees, which discussed with council earlier this morning, are paid 100% by the College of DuPage. There is no foundation cash that pays any foundation staff members. 100% of their salaries is paid by the college and comes from taxpayer money. The college then considers half or a quarter of the salary to be an in-kind contribution to the foundation, but that's really just an accounting entry.
Would you address the College of DuPage's argument that this is moot because everything has been presented other than the subpoena, and the subpoena apparently is beyond your reach or the trial court's reach because it's in the hands of one of the attorneys in the case?
Yes, Your Honor. There are several reasons why the claim against the college is not moot. First, as the circuit court found, under Section 7.2 of FOIA, a public document that is not in the possession of the public body, here the college, but is in the possession of the entity that has contracted with the college, the foundation, is considered to be a public record of the public body. The statutory language is crystal clear that the FOIA request goes to the public body, and then it's the responsibility of the public body to obtain that record from its contractor. Even if you don't look at the contract argument, here, the grand jury subpoena was served on a college employee on college premises. It was received by, possessed by college employees, and I know the college argues that they wear two hats, but that's
what,
really...
What privilege, if any, was raised by the foundation to exempt this document from disclosure? Attorney-client, possibly?
No, Your Honor. There's been no attorney-client privilege argument in this case. There's been no argument that the document falls under a Section 7 FOIA exemption. The only argument the foundation has made, as I understand it, is that the foundation is not a public body.
And why did you not request the trial judge do an in-camera inspection of the alleged document? Is it in part because it wasn't presented or delivered to the court?
Let me answer that in a couple of pieces. The reason nobody requested an in-camera inspection, I'm not sure it was the Tribune's burden to request it. No party had requested it because
it was raised in the brief saying that it was your responsibility, so I'm asking you why.
Well, the trial court didn't think that he needed to do an in-camera inspection because the only question that could have been examined by looking at the document itself is whether the federal grand jury subpoena directly relates to the government function of the foundation, which is the language of Section 7.2. There can be no reasonable contention that it relates to anything but the foundation's government function, because the only function that the foundation performs is the development function for the College of DuPage. That was never in serious contention, so none of the parties nor the trial court believed that an in-camera inspection would really answer any question. It would be a futile effort.
Didn't the foundation at least argue that it was not within the purview of its function?
I believe the foundation has made a circular argument that none of its functions are governmental, and so the federal grand jury subpoena doesn't relate to a governmental function. Neither the foundation nor the college, has argued that the subpoena related to something other than the development functions that the foundation performs. It wasn't a subpoena related to some, personnel issue or something entirely separate from the purpose that the foundation was established for and that is codified in the MOU. I think if there had been, some argument that it was entirely separate from the purpose of connecting.
What
to
is
college,
your response to the claim that you didn't follow the proper procedures relative to a petition for attorney's fees?
Rule 369 is very clear, that if this court affirms, the mandate returns to the trial court, and the trial court can have any further proceedings necessary as if the appeal hadn't happened. Here, if this court affirms, and it would necessarily remand, as Justice Hutchinson said, for enforcement of the injunction, then the trial court has jurisdiction to award attorney's fees. I think it's pretty clear that this court has broad discretion to remand as necessary. The trial court also retains the discretion to reserve jurisdiction. That's very common when a case settles, for example. The trial court reserves jurisdiction to enforce a settlement. And you know, the cases that the college has cited are, you know, entirely distinguishable because they dealt with situations where either there was no remand or 30 days after fee petition was filed, more than 30 days after the judgment issued, such that there was no remaining jurisdiction because the case was already on appeal. Here, the Tribune filed our fee petition, I think, within about 2 weeks of the final judgment, and at the recommendation of the Circuit Court, which has discretion to manage its own docket, we withdrew the fee petition because there were a number of other issues that were being briefed in terms of sealing the court file and other things that aren't particularly relevant here, but there were further proceedings had. The fee petition wasn't then up to date, and the Circuit Court suggested, let's just deal with all of this after we determine whether the case will be affirmed on appeal.
Mr. Ryan suggests that there is a significant privacy right that this foundation maintains, and they're protecting that right by this litigation, essentially. What are you seeking that is private, other than this document?
Nothing, Your Honor. The only document at issue in this FOIA case is the federal grand jury subpoena. The foundation below and in its briefs here has raised this privacy issue, but there's no precedent to support an argument that an institution, as opposed to an individual, has any constitutional right to privacy. It does not. And the Circuit Court below addressed this privacy claim accurately by saying, in the future, if there is a FOIA request for donor records of an anonymous donation or some other arguably private information, that can be dealt with case by case through the existing FOIA exemptions. But that's not before the court now, because the Tribune has not sought those types of documents in this case.
Do you have any inkling, I guess would be the only way to put it, what this federal grand jury subpoena says?
We haven't seen the document, but given the context of the events of April 2015, we believe it generally relates to a scandal involving the former college president who was accused of improperly using foundation and college money for meals and entertainment expenses, for a hunting club membership, and the like, that came out in the press, both in the Tribune and other sources, and law enforcement got interested. And there was the DuPage grand jury subpoena, which the college did turn over eventually, and we suspect that the federal grand jury subpoena relates to that. That's why there is a considerable public interest in this case.
Does the College of DuPage customarily pay its president? I mean, the college, not the foundation, the college.
I assume, yes.
So they're not, the foundation is paying expenses, has under its agreement paying presidential expenses related to fundraising, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Does it pay, any other foundation employees a expenses for fundraising, to your knowledge?
Let me make sure I'm understanding your question. Does the foundation reimburse
any of the other employees of the foundation, which would be Ms. Broad in particular, or her executive person, and I'll mispronounce the name again, so I don't want to do that, are any of their expenses related to fundraising paid by the foundation, to your knowledge?
That's not expressly stated in the MOU. I think, as a practical matter, what was happening was that the former president of the college was essentially using this money as his slush fund. He was whining and dining donors, and
that's not unusual for fundraisers to thank their donors or to encourage their donors or provide incentive to their donors, correct?
That is correct, but it shows why the foundation is performing a governmental function here, because if the foundation did not reimburse the president for these expenses, the college necessarily would reimburse its president for these expenses. And there are a number of other similar functions that the foundation performs that are beyond merely fundraising from private donors. They include things like managing the only alumni database that exists for the College of DuPage. It's created and managed by the foundation. The foundation also supports academic departments, student scholarships. It manages all money that's directed to the college. This indicates that the government function goes far beyond merely that of a booster club or a bake sale. The foundation, under contract with the college, is performing the comprehensive operations that a development office would, and that COD's development office historically did before it contracted these functions to the foundation.
Thank you. Your time is up. You'll have an opportunity to make rebuttal.
Thank you.
Ms. Counsel.
Your Honors, Tim Elliott again on behalf of the College of DuPage. I know my time is limited. I'm anxious to address many of the issues you raised with respect to governmental function. But I do want to start again by addressing a couple points about mootness. The lawsuit was filed on April 29, 2015. The next day, a new board was seated at the College of DuPage, and that board did everything in its power to produce the documents requested by the Tribune. Since July of 2015, so almost 2 years now, COD has been a hostage in this lawsuit over a document it does not have. And in all of the discussions today, in all of the briefing, and all the proceedings in the circuit court, what your honors have not heard is any evidence, any citation to evidence, that COD has a right to compel the council or even the foundation to produce the document. We don't. And in the absence of that right, there is no reason, no cause for us to be in this case. I want to respond to a point that Ms. Block raised, which is she said Section 7.2, which was added to the statute in 2010, crystal clear, creates a cause of action against the public body when a contractor has the document. She's wrong. You can look through Section 7.2, and there is nothing that confers a right of action against the public body. What it does do is it gives a right of action against a government contractor, in this case the foundation. And the best evidence of that is the Tribune's own complaint. Because if you look at count one of the Tribune's complaint, which is the count in which they assert that the 7.2 claim, the only defendant is the foundation. The Tribune itself did not name the College of DuPage as a defendant on that count. Count 7.2 gives a right of action against a government contractor. College of DuPage is not necessary for that cause of action.
If we ultimately hold that the foundation is a subsidiary of the College of DuPage, would that put you back into the game?
No, because you can award relief directly against the foundation. You can say to the foundation, you are before us, you are a defendant, you can produce the document. There's no need to have the College of DuPage to enter an order saying, we order you to try and order them to produce the document. There is no reason why COD would be a necessary party to that suit.
Wait, I didn't think the order said you had to order the foundation. It just made you a party. And it presumed, I think, reading it, that because you are a governmental body, you maintain some indicia of that document, whether it be a copy, a facsimile, a scanned something.
There may be cases where that is the case, but the undisputed evidence in this case is that is not the case. COD has no copy of that document and no power to compel it. And I would submit to Your Honor that is why the Hoff and the Rockford decisions on subsidiary are written in that way. Because the argument in both of those cases was that the government body had some ability to influence the non-public body. They had some leverage over them. Oh, come on, you can make them produce it. You can put pressure on them. And what this court, and I think it was this court in both cases actually, said was that's not enough. It has to be actual control. We are not going to put a public body in the position where, unless they have a majority of the board or other legal right to control, they are going to be on the hook for producing a document.
All right, Judge Gibson said that the control issue was weak, but we could find otherwise because this is definitely on cross appeal and it's been briefed significantly by all parties. So you're saying even if we found that Foundation was a subsidiary, DuPage has absolutely no College of DuPage, pardon me, has absolutely no responsibility for this document?
Under these facts, yes. Those facts would be different if there was some evidence that there is a legal right. So, for example, in the Memorandum of Understanding, there is a contractual right that gave the College of DuPage a right to go demand certain documents and to get them. But that's not present here. The best thing that the jury can say is, well, we think COD has leverage. COD can threaten to terminate the relationship or fire everybody or
cut off funding. COD can do that at any time.
Correct, but that's not enough in this case. There has to be some legal right.
Counsel, your time's up. I have one question. You've made a legal argument on rebuttal, and the gist of your legal argument is economic, is it not? I don't understand how you have any standing here. And standing is based upon an alleged injury, and the only injury I can see, other than to the college's possible loss in reputation based upon the relationship between the college and the foundation, is that you might be jointly or severally liable for the attorney's fees. Am I missing some other injury that would give you standing to intervene in this case if you were not joined as a party?
So I want to make sure I understand your question. So I think the answer is I agree. The college is interest in not being a party is economic. The college doesn't want to pay me and hasn't wanted to pay me to participate in these proceedings. The college doesn't want to have to pay attorney's fees arising out of the suit in which we did everything within our power to resolve the suit 2 years ago. And if your honors were to rule, obviously we disagree, but if your honors were to rule that the case can come back down to the circuit court with the fee petition intact, we would have to defend that.
You answered the question. Thank you.
Your honors,
you may close.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, you had raised a lot of issues regarding the government function. I'm obviously very anxious to address those. I know I'm out of time. But I would just say this. The 2 points on the government function very quickly. Number one, I want to make it very clear that the College of DuPage Foundation does not have public money. In the briefing, there are arguments that there's college property. This is not a situation in which a public college has turned over its endowment or grant funds to a private institution. It hasn't happened.
Do they have it? I thought they didn't have an endowment.
They don't. I mean, there are reserves at the College of DuPage. But there's been no public monies given to the foundation. The money at the foundation is privately raised over 50 years. That's different from what the Tribune said, or at least implied in its briefs. And it's also different from some of the other cases from other states in which grant money or endowment money is turned over. The second point that I want to raise is this. The government function that the circuit court identified was that financially supporting public educational institutions is a government function. That's the language. Financially supporting public educational institutions is a government function. That cannot be the law in the state of Illinois, because it would bring in, as we've said, the band parents, the boosters. It would bring in anyone awarding scholarships to students. And if you're going to say scholarships being awarded to students are a government function, it would also bring in presumably parents or relatives that pay student tuitions. That cannot be the law. And we would strongly urge your honors to adopt the much more limited reasoning that was expressed in the IHSA case, where a government function in the hands of a private party is something that is traditionally or uniquely suited to government, which public fundraising, or excuse me, private fundraising is not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ryan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, I'd like to address the inkling question that Justice Hutchinson raised. You've heard a lot of very big words from the Tribune about scandal and about slush funds. And those are exactly the types of things that newspapers do to sensationalize. It's their motives are to drive profits by selling more papers, by pumping stories. I find it remarkable that the Tribune opened their argument by talking about transparency and how valuable that is. The Tribune knows that certain aspects of American life require confidentiality. And we know that because in the discovery stage in this case, when we asked, give us the sources of your allegations, they refused to answer those. They said that information is confidential and it's protected by the reporter's privilege and it's protected under the First Amendment. They know that private organizations have information that should be kept private under the law. The Tribune's request, how I view them, are double standard. On one hand, they want a private, not-for-profit corporation to release information so that the Tribune could then gin them up, make them into some kind of salacious story in order to sell newspapers. Our inkling of what really happened in this case is that the Tribune outsourced its investigation to a group of internet bloggers who published these stories without regards to whether they're true or false. The Tribune reported on these bloggers in news articles that are in the record, and the Tribunes themselves described them as, quote, the muckrakers of the farm fields. The Tribune said in their own reporting, they quoted from a veteran downstate prosecutor where they described these people as follows, quote, if you're not on their side, you're not only dead wrong, but you're a criminal. Politics is a rough sport.
If you want to spend your time talking about what the Tribune does and what the Tribune doesn't do, that's fine. I'm talking about a grand jury subpoena, and I wanted to know what anybody thought that federal grand jury subpoena covered.
Well, the federal grand juries are confidential. Confidentiality is something that's critically important to our grand juries. And in fact, in 2014, the Illinois Supreme Court said that secrecy in grand jury proceedings are, quote, fundamental to the procedure.
But then I don't see that argued in these briefs.
Well,
this is the first time I'm hearing the foundation raise this.
Well, I think one of the issues that we've raised in our briefs is that what we do is not government. What we do is a private function. The Tribune is here, I guess, arguing that there are some transparency rights that supersede privacy rights of a private organization. With respect to the subpoena, this is something that is confidential by its nature.
Well, that wasn't argued, though, right?
Yeah.
That wasn't argued before the trial court. Because I wondered about that. You know, there is a secrecy of the federal grand jury procedure and all that kind of stuff. That was never mentioned in any of these briefs until right now.
Well, we did mention in the record, and some of the things that did come up in the trial court were about the confidentiality of subpoenas, the inherent confidentiality of that. Some of the record we contain
citations to the local rule of the Northern District, which provides the procedure by which a person can go and get a grand jury subpoena. So we did raise it in the trial court, but...
But if you were, if one of the issues you're fighting is that this is a public record,
right.
One would think that that would be the first argument you would make, that grand jury subpoenas are confidential for a reason. I didn't see that until today.
Well, that our primary argument in the trial court was just not subject to the act.
Right.
And we went through it in detail explaining that we're not a public body. We then explained why we're not a subsidiary of a public body, because under the test that this court announced in Rockford, we don't meet any of the criteria. Third, we argued that the foundation does not do government functions. We don't have a contract to perform a government function. There are some things that only governments can do. Only governments can tax. Only governments can arrest. Only governments can incarcerate. In an international setting, only the government can negotiate a treaty or wage a war. Those are things that are governmental functions. Some things governments do that private citizens do too. Fundraise, open a bank account, send an email.
You know, the problem that I'm having with that particular argument is I don't know that the Booster Club for the Crystal Lake Central Tigers has a memorandum of understanding with Crystal Lake Central that we're going to give you all the money. They don't. I know they don't. You do.
Well, we didn't for 35 some years.
We do now.
We do now. The reason why we did now is because the foundation went essentially leased space from the college, and the college and the foundation wanted to make absolutely crystal clear what that arrangement would be. And they said specifically in that memorandum of understanding, these entities are separate. There is nothing that the foundation does that. Nothing in the memorandum of understanding, nothing that the College of DuPage does that makes the foundation a joint venture partner, a subsidiary, any type of combined relationship. They said crystally clear we're separate. And they did that for good reasons. And so I think this court should honor those reasons. And since we're out of time, I respectfully request that the court find that the foundation is not a public body, not a subsidiary of a public body, and does not perform government functions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Block.
And once again, I appreciate that your entity came under attack, but I just want to talk about this case.
Thank you, Your Honor. I won't address the ad hominem attacks, but I did want to address a couple of the arguments that Foundation's counsel just raised in terms of grand jury secrecy. That was not contested below. The Judge Gibson raised it sort of sua sponte and concluded that because the college had turned over the DuPage grand jury subpoena, which was one of the other documents that the Tribune had initially sought in its three FOIA requests, that there was no serious issue about whether a grand jury subpoena was subject to FOIA. FOIA does have an exemption for documents that for turning over documents that could impede a law enforcement investigation, but the individual who has standing to raise that exemption is the prosecutor. And here, neither the foundation nor the college ever obtained a statement from the U.S. Attorney's Office that turning over this federal grand jury subpoena would in any way impede his investigation. And it's very clear under the Blagojevich case that there's no wholesale exemption for grand jury subpoenas under FOIA. In any event, it simply was not an issue in the briefing below, and the defendants did not meet their burden to prove that exemption, even if it were to be an issue today. In terms of the terms of the memorandum of understanding, I want to address the point that Justice Hutchinson just raised. The former college president, President Bruder, made it an explicit policy to centralize all college fundraising through the foundation. That's expressly stated in Foundation Board minutes that are in the record. The memorandum of understanding was not at bottom an agreement to separate the college and foundation. On the contrary, it's an agreement that all college fundraising will be performed by the foundation. And while it is technically true that I don't believe there was money that was formally held in title by the college that was literally transferred to the foundation, the fact is, and Ms. Brode and Ms. Kuhn testified, that if a donor approached the college offering a donation, the college would direct that person to write a check to the foundation. So, and the MOU specifically states that the foundation holds that money in trust for the college.
Did the MOU originate under President, did you say his name, Bruder?
Yeah, it was signed in 2009, I believe that that was under his tenure, but it's still in existence, it's still in effect, it's still the governing document that controls the relationship between the college and the foundation, and it establishes that it's far more than just a fundraising relationship. As has been discussed before, the foundation pays the president's expenses, manages the college's entire endowment, because the college doesn't have one.
Council for College of DuPage says, I can't do anything, other than maybe have to pay fees, which he's not excited about. But I can't do anything. Why are they still in the case?
They're still in the case for several reasons. First, as previously discussed, under Section 7.2 of FOIA, a public record that is not in the possession of a government body but is in the possession of its contractor is determined to be, by statute, a public record of the public body. There is a statutory presumption that there's a cause of action against both the public body and the contractor to retrieve that document.
And that's not because the contractor might be a subsidiary or a public body, it's that they are a contractor.
Correct. It's a separate argument from the subsidiary argument, although we also believe that as a subsidiary of the college controls the foundation's staff. The executive director of the foundation, of course, pursuant to the bylaws of the foundation, must be a college employee. The foundation's board of directors cannot terminate her. She is employed by the college. Her employment is confirmed by the college board of directors. If the foundation decided, we don't want you to be our executive director anymore, that doesn't affect her pay. It doesn't affect her position with the college. She remains 100% paid by the college. You know, her role is not affected by any decision that the foundation's board could or couldn't make. The same with all of the other employees or staff members of the foundation. They're college employees, 100% paid by the college, and it just strains credulity to argue that the college cannot control these individuals. And
are there pension benefits? Are there pension benefits based on the full amount of their salary, which is the combined total of what's attributed to the foundation and COD? Or is the pension benefit based only on the part that is COD employment?
There's no evidence specifically addressing that question in the record, but we do know from the record that 100% of these employees' salaries is paid by the college. So I would have to assume that their pension is calculated based on their college salary, which is all of their salary. There is no cash paid to these staff members by the foundation. It's sort of considered a new kind of contribution, but they are 100% paid by the college.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions?
Well, I was going to ask you if the next FOIA request would be for the pension records and workman's comp records and a few other things. But I think that's just speculation.
The Tribune respectfully requests that this court uphold the circuit court's injunction requiring both the college and the foundation to disclose the federal grand jury subpoena under FOIA section 7.2 to reverse the holding that the foundation is not a subsidiary of the college, to hold that the federal grand jury subpoena is also a public record of the college, and to remand for consideration of the Tribune's fee petition.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement. The court is adjourned. I believe at this point we're supposed to take questions.
I believe the dean is going to address.
And counsel, you are, I believe, allowed to go if you choose to do so. We're not here to talk to the deans about process.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. We are very pleased to have you here. And we have an extra chair. There we go. We just got a few minutes before we have a reception upstairs. I want to give the students an opportunity for just a few questions and answers from the bench. So if anyone has, obviously not substantive, not relating directly to the case at bar, but questions about process. Go ahead.
I've heard some appellate judges really like oral arguments and some don't. Right? Like Justice Thomas in particular thinks that it's not that effective. Former Justice Scalia thought it was pretty helpful. What do you guys think? Thank you.
Okay.
I was trying to find your face. So.
I made myself fairly clear in most of my 22 years here that I think if there is a brief, well-written, and covers issues that will resolve the case, I'm comfortable.